Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 183 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. This week we're talking about winter cars, the best winter cars at different budgets. So we start with a very, very modest budget, £1,000. And then we go all the way out to 100 grand and actually over 100 grand because we couldn't resist. And we talk about what exactly is it that makes a car a good winter car or a bad winter car. We've tried to come up with some sensible suggestions, but also a handful of slightly daft suggestions. Before we get started, I will just remind you all to rate and review the podcast. Please give us a glowing review and a 5-star rating. It really helps. And while you're doing it, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button. Thank you ever so much for doing that. And thank you for listening and enjoy the episode. We are talking winter cars this week and the cars we would choose to drive through winter at different price points. Briefly, though, we're just going to touch on the US Grand Prix in Austin, aren't we? Because it was a fairly sort of absorbing race, but I think there were a handful of interesting themes going on. The order hasn't been shaken up, but have Mercedes edged towards that Red Bull, do you think?
Definitely. Yeah. I've also figured out how to completely even the gap between Red Bull and all the other and the rest of the cars on the grid.
Make the Red Bull drive on stilts.
All you need to do over the winter. Alternatively, over the winter, just resurface all the tracks.
Yes, yeah,
and make them really bumpy. Because it's not that great. Okay, this wasn't the bumpiest circuit. It wasn't as bumpy as where do they really struggle? Singapore. But I mean, it was actually nice hearing Max a bit sort of flustered and a bit stressed and having to sort of work. And actually, I think what it does show is just how much he's been in cruise and collect all year, really. And
it's great to see him cross the line, take the flag, and have a car 2 seconds behind him. And not because the field was compressed with a late safety car or whatever. There was a car.
No, there were no safety cars, were there? Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I put a little poll, actually, and I think most people, although not by a big majority, think that Max was really pushed. I think that he was just looking after the car in those last few laps, and I think if Lewis got anywhere near sort of DRS, I think Max would have just, you know, I think he just wanted to keep something in the tank. But even so, it was good, and I was very sorry that Lewis got disqualified through clearly absolutely no fault of his own. But then again, I think they will come away happy that this new floor of theirs has made clear. I think it's made a big step, actually. The only slightly peculiar thing is George, who, as people listen to this podcast will know, I'm a big fan of. He was kind of nowhere all weekend, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. he was
almost sort of Checo to Lewis. You know, the way that, you know, Perez is to Verstappen. He just wasn't there, was he?
Yeah, so Lewis disqualified for it was too much wear on the underside of the car on the plank, wasn't it? Which yeah. suggests that they were running the car fractionally too low, maybe. But Mercedes has said, well, it's a very bumpy track. There was only one practice session. So perhaps they were, to some degree, mitigating circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately... Yeah, but somebody said on Twitter, you know, 8 of the 10 teams didn't find it a problem.
Yeah, they only tested 4 cars. And the curious thing is, they checked Lewis's car, found that he contravened the regs, and they didn't check George's, nor did they check Carlos Sainz's, because Leclerc, as we know, was also excluded.
Did they check? Did they? Presumably, they would have tested Max's.
I think they tested the top four.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh well, then. Well, that, I mean, that would explain why. Hang on. Carlos finished ahead of Leclerc, didn't they? Didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, but he was off the podium, wasn't he? He finished fourth. But the McLaren was clearly fine because Lando finished third, promoted to second. So yeah, I mean, some of the teams were clearly fine. But who knows? Maybe half the cars on the grid were contravening the rules yesterday. We'll never know. But ultimately, yeah, from a Mercedes Hamilton point of view, it doesn't really matter. I mean, the fans of Lewis want to see him beat Checo to second in the title in the championship fight. But
yeah, well,
it
that took a big
really
step
matter.
Back, didn't it?
It did, and it doesn't really matter. No one's going to be leaping up and down for Lewis finishing second in the championship. And yeah, I don't think it's too big a deal.
Look back over history and honestly tell me who came second in almost any championship.
Yeah, no one cares. It doesn't matter.
No one cares. It doesn't matter. I mean, it probably matters financially. Certainly the constructors, it matters enormously to the teams. Because that's just money, isn't it? But otherwise, yeah, as you absolutely say, who cares? First loser. Doesn't matter, does it?
And actually, more important is if Mercedes really have taken a step forward, that's more important than a few points on the board, isn't it? Certainly from Lewis's point of view.
It's interesting, though. I mean, given the championship has gone, yeah, I'll be very Machiavellian here. So there really is nothing to fight for. I guess they want to come. What can they do? Can they come? Yeah, they want to be second in the constructors, don't they?
I guess
there is that to fight for. But I wouldn't necessarily have made such a big fuss about that flaw or the big upgrade or the big improvement, because all you're doing is putting Red Bull on notice that they might have a bit more of a fight on their hands next year than they're expecting.
It's sort of prodding the bear, isn't it?
A little bit. I'm sure you know, far more intelligent, informed brains than mine decided what to do and how to do it. But if you've got something which does seem to me to be a big step, and maybe there are other big steps they are keeping quiet about, I don't know. Given the championship is gone, I might have just kept that under my hat until next year.
Let's just hope next year is much more competitive. I'm sort of craving a competitive F1 season.
Yeah, and I thought, can I give just a quick shout out? I mean, he got driver of the day. I'm not sure he should have got it, but I did think that Lando, I mean, you know, for a while, he probably, you know, he could have had the quickest car out there. It's just and we see this, don't we, time and time again. You can build a car that might be as quick as a Red Bull over a lap, might be as quick as a Red Bull over 10 laps. But not 20.
It's not enough.
And the moment those tyres go into that degradation, I mean, Lando, he double stopped, didn't he? And at the beginning of all three stints, he was really quick. And by the end of each stint, he was really slow.
It's such a double-edged sword, that, isn't it? Being light, being gentle on your tyres. Because at cooler races, you have such trouble firing them up. And in qualifying, one warm-up lap might not be enough to get your tyres in the zone. But that's where the Red Bull is just magic.
That is the witchcraft of the Red Bull, isn't it?
Unbelievable. Yeah. It is just staggering. Anyway. Okay, well, that's enough F1. Winter cars. Different budgets.
Winter cars.
But first of all, we need to just quickly define a couple of things. Winter. We're not talking Alaska here, are we? We're not talking minus 20, 30 degrees, or even Northern Europe. Snow. We're talking, certainly in my mind, we're talking an average British winter. So not a mild one. Not a totally sort of anomalous one. I'm imagining a kind of mix of weather. Icy, frosty mornings. Some snow. Lots and lots of rain. Filthy roads.
Crap on the roads. Leaves.
It's dark.
Slippery.
It's miserable.
Yeah.
And you want a car that makes all of that okay.
Yeah. And occasionally. And, you know, let's not forget that people buy cars, and they absolutely do, for usage scenarios they don't expect ever to be in, or even usage scenarios they expect to be in very, very rarely. It's why, you know, Audi TTs outsell Porsche Caymans, because they've got rear seats. And it's why people never take their Range Rovers off roads. Nevertheless, I think when we are talking about these winter cars, we have to at least keep in the back of our mind, because they do happen, certainly around where I live, every so often you'll get a proper winter.
Yeah.
And if you want to keep moving, you need the equipment to do the job.
Mm.
So I think we just need to bear that in mind as we go through this.
So what are the sort of attributes then of a good winter car for you? I mean, clearly grip and traction are important, but that might be more down to the tyres than the car itself.
Well, I mean, jobs 1, 2, and 3 are tyres.
Mm.
I mean, we'll come on to this in a minute, I'm sure, when we start talking about what you spend £1,000 on. But, yeah. I mean, you need to be able to see, you need visibility. You want a car that's, it's got, you know, it's basic stuff. It's like sort of decent headlights. And maybe some good safety systems and all that sort of thing. And certainly the cars on my list, you know, very few of them, in fact, probably none of them are actually new. So this is going to be cars that you can buy on a budget, but also just cars that are, I mean, certainly when the going gets really tough, people think, I just want the biggest, heaviest thing I can get. It's actually,
no,
to some extent, not what you want.
Mm.
You want something that is light and nimble. And that's the problem with, and I guess one of the reasons we're doing this podcast, is there is a trade-off, isn't there, between cars that are absolutely technically at their best in bad weather and the sort of cars that you feel most secure and at home in those sort of conditions, even if it might be something of an illusion.
Mm. That's true. I to build on that, I also want, you're right, big and heavy isn't necessarily the way, but certainly a substantial car. I know there are people who use their Caterhams and their Elises through winter. That's not me. I'm not up for that. I want a bit
it's
more
not
comfort.
Me either.
I want a bit more comfort. I want maybe heated seats. I want, certainly for a proper rotten British winter's day, I want ride quality, I want stability. I'm not looking for edgy handling balance and adjustability on the lift.
No, I mean, your brain goes into a completely different mode, doesn't it? It sort of goes into almost survival mode. You want to be, you want to feel safe, and you want to be, you know, warm.
You want to sort of hunker down, don't you, for winter?
Shout out for seat heaters.
Yes.
Every so often, in the middle of winter, a car will turn up, and it will be specked up the wazoo, but someone's forgotten to tick the seat heater box, and I just think, oh, really?
What have you done?
I had an Audi TTS convertible spider thing in one of the sort of last edition things in a week or two ago, and I sort of looked around, and it didn't have seat heaters, and I was so annoyed, but nothing like as annoyed as I was on the day it was going back, when the bloke came to collect it, and I was just sitting there, just going through it with him and that sort of thing, and I suddenly saw on one of the vents a button with a seat heater thing in the middle of it.
Yeah, they're hidden in the button.
It did have bloody seat heaters, and I couldn't find them. So it was entirely my fault. And I thought, I've been going around with a frozen backside for the last week, and there was no need.
And you needn't have done. Okay, so final thoughts on this before we get stuck in. In the middle of winter, I'm probably not getting up early for a solo drive. I'm probably not going to do that. For me, that can wait until spring. So I don't need a thrilling engine, a great soundtrack. I'm not too worried about how crisp the steering is, all that road tester stuff. My priorities change. Even down to the details, range becomes important, because I don't want to be standing at the petrol station in a chilly breeze for
dark,
3-4
raining
minutes all the time. Yeah, I don't want to be doing that. So if I can have 800 miles between fill-ups, great. However, and this is the important point for me, all those attributes, they matter. But these cars, they still need to tickle the enthusiast in you.
Do they? Interesting.
I'm saying the car enthusiast, not necessarily the driving enthusiast.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. Okay, there is one car on my list, which there's literally a car on my list which you would identify as being an enthusiast's car.
Okay. But okay, when I say enthusiast car, I mean it has to be interesting in some way. It doesn't have to be a great driver's car, just interesting in some way, rather than completely boring.
It certainly can't be unpleasant in any way, because that would just annoy you, and that's the last thing you need when you're already more than annoyed with the fact that you're cold and wet and it's dark and everything else. So you certainly need a car which you can just get into and still feel at home in, where everything is where you want it to be, and it drives. It responds well. Mm. It's not a car that you have to kind of second guess where it's going to be every time you turn the wheel. It's going to do what you want it to do, and it's going to be satisfying to drive, if not actively fun. You're absolutely right. That is important. Because, go on.
One last question before we start with our £1,000 cars. Have you got any two-wheel drive cars on your list? Don't say what they are.
I have certainly cars on my list that could be two-wheel drive.
Okay.
Well, we're going to talk about this very shortly. I think that there is an argument for two-wheel drive, but it doesn't preclude the argument for four-wheel drive.
Okay. Fine. All right. That's enough build-up. £1,000. Were you finding plenty of stuff that you thought fit the bill, or were you sort of scraping the barrel?
No, I absolutely wasn't. And at the end of it, do you know what I concluded? If I had £1,000 to spend on a winter car, I would buy myself the best set of winter tyres for whatever my daily driver was.
That's probably right, yeah. And stick your summer tyres you've got space.
Because all the sorts of things that we're going to talk about in the sub £5,000 category, where there's plenty, you just can't get one for that kind of money. Or if you can, it's going to be a bloody nightmare. And the last thing you want on those cold, wet, dark days is getting in a car and not really knowing whether it's going to get you where you want to go.
Oh, God.
So I kind of drew a blank, and I just thought, I mean, can I just do a little bit on the winter tyre argument? I did a job years ago for Autocar where we took two Skoda Yetis, absolutely identical cars, same engines, same everything, apart from one was four-wheel drive, one was front-wheel drive. And so we left the four-wheel drive car on its summer tyres, and we put the front-wheel drive car on winter tyres. And we went down to a test track, which rather conveniently had a light dusting of snow. And we did a load of tests. And oh my goodness. Mm. If ever you wanted to be convinced of the merits of winter tyres, you should have just been there. I mean, the four-wheel drive car was left completely floundering. The only thing it could do better than the two-wheel drive car was gain speed.
Yeah.
Yeah. All it had was traction. It could accelerate better. But in terms of braking, the stuff actually that you really worry about, the stuff that you really need a car to do, braking ability and the ability to not fall off a road when you go around a corner, the two-wheel drive car on winter tyres was, I mean, just postcodes better. Mm. I mean, I can't remember what the distances were. The braking tests were absolutely terrifying. It was like a football pitch difference between the two. So if you've got £1,000 to spend on a winter car, do yourself a favour. Don't go and buy a shonky old unreliable bucket of bolts. Get yourself some decent rubber.
Talking of shonky unreliable bucket of bolts, I've got a few of those.
Yeah.
I'm just going to rattle through a few. These are a few that I found.
Go on, make the case.
But they all... I've dismissed these three already. But there is one that I think... No, I'm not sure. So I found a 2009 Subaru Outback. Four-wheel drive, turbo diesel, manual. The spec says it has an LSD, actually, and this one came with a full set of winter tyres, heated seats. I thought, here we go. It's a bit too expensive, £1,230.
No, that's right. Yeah, they take a grand in cash, wouldn't they?
I think so. I thought, here we go, this is the one, but it's been sawn for 2 years and it's being sold as spares or repair.
Run!
That's no good. Okay, and then I saw 2008 Skoda Octavia Scout.
Yeah.
So that's a four-wheel drive one, manual, TDI, 175,000 miles.
Yeah, probably right.
I thought, here we go, £999. But then I read the ad, price reduced due to clutch pedal being sluggish to return, causing difficulty in selecting gears, particularly reverse. Again, no. Because you're right, you cannot be let down by your winter car.
No, I mean, all these cars you're talking about, they're on my sub 5K list. I mean, a Scout and an Outback are cracking ideas, but not for less than £1,000.
Yeah, too cheap. They're too cheap, aren't they?
Yeah.
So the last one that I found Again, I've dismissed it already. 2006 Nissan Murano with the 350Z engine. It's got that 3.5 litre V6 with 230.
That wasn't a good car when it was new.
230 horsepower with a CVT gearbox. But four-wheel drive, heated seats.
What were you saying about them having to be nice to drive?
1,200 quid. But yeah, one cylinder isn't working. So it's a V5.
One cylinder V5.
So, yeah.
Okay. So can we say that we have established that you can't spend less than £1,000 on a decent winter car?
Yeah. So the only one that came close was a 20-year-old Audi A4, 3-litre V6 petrol manual, 220 horsepower, four-wheel drive, 153,000 miles, run on V-Power. I love that detail. Heated seats, 1,350 quid. So that's close, but who
is it
knows?
A Catsy or?
No. That's not
I
bad.
I mean, I just, it's not bad at all, but it does sound, I think if you went to see it, you'd find out something you didn't already know.
Probably.
You just don't want to be, whatever you get into, it just needs to, and actually, which is why the cars that I've chosen for less than 5K aren't, because there are any number of full-size SUVs that are ancient and got a bazillion miles.
Oh,
on them.
Loads.
That
that's
kind of
right. There are loads.
But I haven't chosen any of them because I'd just be scared of them, and also one big bill and you have to write the car off.
I think, actually, the single most important attribute of a winter car is that it gets you there. Whether that means it has the grip and the traction that you need to navigate an icy, snowy road, or that it's reliable. It just has to get
you
there.
It has to get you there. Mm. That is job one, isn't it? In one piece.
So have you got any candidates for £1,000, or did you just decide to
go
for tyres?
No, I didn't even bother. I had a look, and I just thought this is not a sensible amount of money to be recommending to people who kindly listen to this podcast should be spending on a car for those purposes.
No. Okay. All right. Let's get up to £5,000 then.
Unless it's a recreational thing, which sort of, it lives in the shed and it only comes out when the snow comes down and you know, without it, you can't go and get yourself a pint of milk. Or use it for letting your kids drive around a field if you happen to own a field or whatever. But no, not as proper transport. Absolutely not.
Okay. £5,000 then, a bit more sensible.
I've got two absolute crackers here.
Go on.
Absolute crackers. Okay, number one. And these are sensible cars which can be bought in good condition and which really shouldn't let you down. Duster.
Ooh. Yeah. I've never driven one. Are they good?
Good cars.
Yeah.
Four-wheel drive. Actually, most Dusters aren't four-wheel drive, so you need to be careful that you tick that box. Mm. I've always been, actually, people just make jokes out of them. I went and did a job with a Sandero a year or two ago, where we went and did a supercar shoot. We took it off into the mountains, and it was sort of an examination of the nature of fun and how much can be derived just from the environment that you happen to be in, the fact that you've got no other purpose than to enjoy yourself. And I concluded that as long as the car is actively not unpleasant, you can have a huge amount of fun in almost anything. And there is nothing unpleasant about a Duster. It's very cheap, but it is so supremely fit for purpose. And if you spend £4,000, you'll get a really nice one. It'll have four-wheel drive. It'll get you where you're going. It'll have enough equipment. And you'll never have to worry about it because, you know, the technology is frankly so old on it. It's been proven a million times over. And I just think that's a really smart, not literally smart, sensible, I guess, choice for that kind of car.
Well, the other thing is, it'll be on skinny little tyres, won't it? And once you've got some winters on, that's what you want.
Oh, I mean, a Duster on winters. Mm. It's not heavy. Mm. People always forget. Weight is your enemy. Well, basically, weight's always the enemy, but it's particularly the enemy if you are, you know, lacking traction because you're just giving your tyres more work to do. So it'll be light, it'll be on skinny tyres, it'll have ground clearance, you know, just terrific.
A Panda 4x4 would be similar, wouldn't it?
Well, see, funnily enough, there was that's the other car on my list. You see, I think that there are certain circumstances in which a Panda 4x4 on winters would go further than anything else. It would go further than any Range Rover or anything else. Mm. It, you know, I mean, clearly you would run into ground clearance and issues and that sort of thing. But actually, round here, when the snow is... Because what happens here, and that's what happens in most days, the snow comes down. The snow itself is not really a problem if you know what you're doing and you're a bit sensible. It's when it's people have been on it for a bit, and so it stayed cold and it started to compact. And that's when it gets really, really slippery. And so you need a bit of ground clearance, but you need traction. And for traction, what you need is a light car, so your tyres don't have to work too hard, four-wheel drive and winters. And what's the lightest thing you can think of, which also comes with four-wheel drive, which you can slap some winters onto, and it's a Panda.
Mm. And you still see them in ski resorts, right at the top of the mountain. There they are.
Yeah, of course. There's a reason for that.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay.
And again, bomb-proof mechanicals.
Yeah. Well.
Lovely. I think you're about to say something which I've got in my next category, but I might be completely wrong.
I don't think I am.
Has it already come up on this podcast?
No. I'm going to disregard of my own advice here. And only because I was surprised to see it in the £5,000 category. Snow maybe not so much, but the rest of the time. 2010, Volkswagen Phaeton. 3-litre TDI auto, four motion, so four-wheel drive. 116,000 miles. Stick some winter tyres on it. I mean, okay, it's not going to be particularly good in the snow, is it? But... on a grim,
or in anywhere which has, I don't know, ULEZ or anything like that. I mean, you'd never be able to drive it into London, would you?
No, never mind that. I live a long way from London. But I think on a Monday morning at 6 a.m. when you're getting in the car and it's horrible outside and you fire up the heat seaters,
the heat seaters,
and it's going to ride beautifully. It's going to be quiet.
Yeah.
You're going to be quite happy in that. It's going to be an extension of your living room.
Yeah, and you'll have that little blinking engine warning light flashing away at you.
And then when something does go wrong,
the seat motor on the passenger seat, you know, suddenly stops working, and then I had a brother who had a Phaeton for quite a long time, and he did love it. And to be fair, it didn't go wrong. I think it was almost exactly that car.
Really?
And he bought it for buttons, because you can. I think it's a really interesting choice.
Okay. Can I give you a slightly more sensible one?
Yeah.
2006 Alfa Romeo 159. 3.2 V6 Q4 with the four-wheel drive, manual. 70,000 miles. The ad says everything works perfectly down to the seat heaters, which is fairly honest remarkable for a nearly 20-year-old Alpha.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it?
So he's honest.
That means it's all about to go wrong, isn't it?
Yeah.
Be honest with me. So you go and buy that car.
Yes.
Would you trust it?
You're not going to, are you? You're going to worry.
You're going to worry.
Yeah.
That's the one thing you know. If this car is going to make you worry, then it shouldn't even, to me, it shouldn't even be considered. Because as we said, I think you're absolutely right. Numero uno consideration is that you don't have to worry about it, that it's going to start, that it's going to get you there. Mm. I'd worry about it. And even if I was wrong to worry about it, even if it turned out to be okay, doesn't actually matter. Because it's not the fact that it goes wrong. It's the fact that you're worrying about it going wrong, which makes it a poor choice.
You have to be able to trust it. I agree.
Yeah.
However, a V6 Alfa Romeo... There is something
little
tempting about
under your bonnet. I mean, I can absolutely see the appeal.
I bet you'd find you'd find an Alfa Brera for the same money as well. I'm sure the coupe.
Oh God, I'd much rather have the 159. I'm a huge Brera fan, I'm afraid.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Let's double the budget. 10 grand.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, well, okay. Do you want to start?
I've gone non-four-wheel drive here. It's the only one. So I'm definitely going to need a set of winter tyres for this as well. But I found a 2010 BMW 335D Touring. And that's that twin-turbo inline-six diesel engine with 428 pound-foot of torque. Which isn't what you need going through two contact patches, is it? But you don't have to use it all.
So hang on. So you're going for... this is the best winter cars. The worst.
I've got winter tyres.
Okay. So if you wanted to specify what you really didn't want in a winter car, you'd have the engine at one end, driving the wheels at the other, with an enormous amount of torque.
But we're not talking. We're not talking an Alaskan clearance. Winter. Remember. But okay, again, this goes back to the phaeton thing. As long as it's not icy and snowy, which I admit it can be in winter, that would be lovely.
You have been altogether more, how can I put this, imaginative in your choices than I have been. Can I tell you, I had one of those as, this is absolutely true, I had one of those as a long-termer, and I wasn't at the time living where I live now. I was living in a little cottage about 6-7 miles away from here, and there was, to get to it, you had to go down a road, and the first part of that road was a gentle rise. And one weekend, I took it down there before Christmas, the plan being to spend a fortnight down there over Christmas, because we also had a little place in town. And I got to this gentle incline, got about a quarter of the way up it. It started to slip back down the gentle incline because there was some snow and ice about. I parked it in the lay-by, and that was literally the last time it moved for a fortnight. It just stayed there because I couldn't get it home. It wasn't on Winters there, and if it had been on Winters, I would have got it home without any problem at all. Mm.
Gah. Yeah, £428 foot though. Nice.
Yeah, how much money?
10 grand. 99.
How many miles?
98. Okay, so winter stuff aside, that's a nice
forget,
car.
I got to say, I mean, let's forget we're doing a winter podcast here. That's just a good car, isn't it?
Lovely.
That's just a good smoker, isn't it?
Love that. Yeah, it'd be fantastic. Yeah. It looks in good nick as well. It's not an old rotter.
Yeah.
But go on, 10 grand gives a more sensible one.
Okay, well, I mean, the one we've already mentioned is a Yeti.
Yeah, oh, that was very much on my long list, yeah.
A Yeti, okay, you don't have to spend 10 grand on a Yeti. You can spend four grand on a Yeti. But if you spend 10 grand on a Yeti, you'll get a young car, with all the bells and whistles on it, but just going back to this thing about, you'll get a car with very few miles on it, with an immaculate service history, and it'll just be. I can remember the Yeti when it first came out, and this was right at the sort of dawn of the sort of crossover SUV era. Just thinking, it's the only one that I would want to actually drive about, because they do drive really well.
Yeah.
You can get a four-wheel drive one with a 6-speed manual gearbox, all the toys, really, really comfortable car. 2-litre diesel engine, indestructible. I think that is, if there was a real pragmatist choice among all the things that I've got on here, that would be it, because that's just the one which, it won't be absolutely outstanding at anything, but it is a car without serious fault. And for that kind of money, I think it's, if you're thinking about spending 6, 7, 8 grand on one of these things, a Yeti would just be fantastic. There are lots of them about, so you've got lots of choice. No need to put up with anything a bit dodge. You can really go out there, do your research, get a great car, stick it on Winters, and you're sorted. You're absolutely sorted.
When they were brand new, Skoda did a launch event up in Scotland, which included some proper off-roading. And it had been wet and disgusting for weeks, so the ground was terrible. The cars had winter tyres on, but they were otherwise totally standard. And we were going through really gloopy, up-to-the-axles mud. Yeah. And the things just kept going. Just kept going. It was remarkable. So I know we're not talking off-roading, but they've got some capability away from...
Yeah, but this isn't an off-roading podcast, is it? Because if this were an off-roading podcast, we'd be talking about other stuff. It's about keeping going. It's exactly what you're talking about. It's just keeping going through the worst conditions that people are likely to encounter, which doesn't involve, disappearing into the scenery.
There you go. Good shout. Really good shout. Have you got another one, or are we up?
Yeah, no, I'm going to break all my rules.
Go on then.
My mate Jules has got a car, and I just love it. I go in it a lot because he's very kind enough to give me a lift back from the pub in it, and he goes absolutely everywhere in it, and it's probably the sort of car you shouldn't buy. But I think it is just such a fantastically fit-for-purpose machine, and it is a 2011 Discovery 4 with 195,000 miles on the clock. And the thing with those cars is, you hear all sorts of horror stories, don't you? His just doesn't go wrong. There's one particular problem that those cars have, which is known with their manifolds, but they are cheap to replace, and his, I think, has gone one. But all the problems that you kind of hear with transmissions and transfer case and that sort of thing, his just, it just, you know, and I think what happens with those cars is you get good ones and bad ones. He's definitely got a good one. And they are so, because they are so authentic, they're not sort of trying to be fashionable or anything, and you just sit in them, and they just feel right. Everything is chunky. Everything feels like quality. It's lasted incredibly well. And I know that it's heavy, and what we said about, you know, heavy cars and going off-road and that sort of thing, so I do qualify it with that. And I would possibly be a bit worried about it, but the experience of that car is that, you know, he's had it, I think he bought it when it had done, like, 90,000 miles, and he's done 100,000 miles on it since then. And it's just, you know, and I know he would drive it to Switzerland tomorrow without even thinking about it. So, yeah, just go for
it. That is a great shout. That is a great shout. Okay, we're going up to 25 grand. This is where I get quite sporty.
You see, I've got something slightly, well, not sporty, slightly something alternative.
To get us going at 25 grand, I'm going to first suggest a 2020 VW Golf R, Mark 7.5, so the facelift, 300 horsepower, four-wheel drive. I used a pre-facelift Mark 7 Golf R through winter a good few years ago. Lovely. Lovely. It didn't have super sticky tyres on it, so it always had grip and traction, always. They're not ludicrously heavy, those cars. They have lovely supple chassis, so you're not getting bounced about, you know, and they do find grip in the road. Ideal. Good cabin, comfy seats, heated seats. I'd be very, very happy to knock about in one of those again.
And also, just, you know, as we know, and as we said on this podcast before, those cars are like peak VW, aren't they? These are cars that were engineered with the budgets that they had before Dieselgate, before they had to pay to electrify their entire business. So, you know, the quality of those cars, your chances of, you know, of getting in a car that's going to let you down are probably pretty slight. It's no surprise, is it, that you've just come out of owning a Golf 7.5. I own a Golf 7.5, and we're talking about a Golf 7.5. That's not a coincidence, is it? And obviously, an R with four-wheel drive. What would you get, DSG or manual?
I actually prefer the DSG.
Yeah. And for winter as well.
Yeah. Just
let the computers think about it for you. Yeah. I think that's a really good shout. Yeah.
All right, let me give you my second one, and then you can jump in. This one's a bit different, a bit riskier. 2003 Porsche 911 Carrera 4S. So that's a 996-2. Four-wheel drive, manual, full Hartec engine rebuild, less than 10,000 miles ago, 92,000 miles, 25 grand. I fancy that. It's not going to depreciate from there.
No, it's not.
I wouldn't have thought.
No. And with the engine rebuild, so presumably all the issues will have been addressed. It's still not going to be a cheap car to run.
No, you're going to have to put a bit of money into it. That is
true. And it'll have sod all ground clearance.
Yeah.
So not ideal, but actually a very imaginative choice. And for some people, they'll be thinking, oh, that's quite interesting, actually, because I don't really need the ground clearance. And maybe if it's not going to depreciate, I could get the old man maths out and think, well, the money I save in it not depreciating, I spend on running the thing.
Spend on running. Yeah. Well, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I'd really fancy that. I would really fancy that. Go on, let's have your suggestions.
Okay. So you've been really quite interesting and enterprising there. I'm going to be really boring now. Okay, this is what I can't believe I've turned into Captain Sensible over the weekend, but it appears to have happened. again, I'm just thinking about what would I, if I'm looking out the bedroom window on a Monday morning and it's absolutely filthy and I just want to get somewhere quickly, capably, and without having to worry about it. 2016 Audi A6 Allroad with that stonking, what do they call it? The twin turbo V6 diesel in it with 315 horsepower. I had one of those as a long-termer. It was absolutely outstanding. One of the best Audis I've driven. I can remember I went and did the, what do they call it? You know, the Three Peaks Challenge when you go and climb Snowdon and Scafell Pike and Ben Nevis. I didn't do it in 24 hours because I had a daughter with me. I did it in 48 and it was altogether more fun as a result. But nevertheless, it was just the two of us. And we were just nipping between these mountains quite often in quite bad weather in this Audi. And also little things like you'd be going down some really narrow little lane on the approach to one of these places and a tractor would come the other way or a car would come the other way and you'd have to take to the grass verge or just drive off the road completely and everything would be so sodden. In any normal car, you'd actually be worried about getting back onto the road. Mm. Or going to go and, I don't know, park in some field at some festival or a point to point or whatever you're going to go and do. And it just, you know, bit of additional ground clearance, winter tires, obviously, bomb-proof mechanicals, really fast, quiet, comfortable, very sensible.
Yeah, but that does the job just superbly, doesn't it?
It does.
Have you found, is 25 grand a decent budget for one of those?
Yeah, I found one here, which a 2016 car, 50k on the clock, 25 grand. Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm well into that. Go on.
I've got another one, which is slightly, you'll be glad it's slightly less sensible.
Go on.
But I want one.
Yeah.
G-Wagon.
Oh, my God. Right, so what are you getting for 25 grand?
You're getting a 30-year-old car. Yeah, so you're getting a 94 G wagon, a GE300. So a chunky 3-litre diesel.
Yeah.
Lots of miles on it. But it's a G wagon. They are just built like nothing else on earth, aren't they? And I certainly wouldn't worry about a G wagon anything like as much as I worry that anything else of that kind of age and those sorts of miles. And I'd just be happy in it. I would just be so. I mean, you can obviously go and spend 175 grand on a new G63 I just never ever would, but something like that, where the price is, containable at least, never going to depreciate. It's never going to be worth less than that. I think, and also that it won't be a bucket of bits. It'll be a perfectly sensible. Decent car. It won't ride very well, it'll be quite noisy, all those sorts of things, but I offset that with the knowledge that you're in a G-Wagon and you're basically driving the coolest off-roader there's ever been.
Some mud and snow tires,
and then
that'll go everywhere
with your three diff locks. You'll be absolutely tip-top in that.
You're not going to worry, are you?
No.
Good shout. Right, we've got one more price category.
I've actually got two, because I think we need to go over 100, only because otherwise I can't have one car.
Okay, let's do 100 grand then. I'll give you mine. We only drove one of these for the first time a few weeks ago, and you wrote about them in the group test that we did, the BMW M3 Touring group test, up against your old, now departed M340i long-termer. But my nomination is the Alpina B3 Touring xDrive. I'm sort of in two minds about this, actually, because it's got 500 horsepower thereabouts. What's going to happen if you stick something like that on winter tyres? Is that going to be problematic?
No, I don't think it will. It's got four-wheel drive. It's quite soft. Problematic is ground clearance, isn't it? Those cars, they have side skirts and they have quite a low chin spoiler, that sort of thing, and I'd be worried about damaging that. But it's going to get you where you want to go.
I accept those shortcomings. I'm choosing it because, actually, for a year round everyday car, particularly for a family, I don't think there's anything I would choose over one of those. They look fantastic. They go like stink.
But we're not talking year round, are we?
We're not. We're not. No, I know. But this, just sort of generally speaking about the B3 Touring,
yeah.
They're great to drive. They are super comfy. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Quiet, good seats.
Yeah.
Great cabin.
Yeah.
I'd actually, as a family car, there's nothing I'd rather have.
Yeah. I am, okay, so this is my sort of choice in this category, because they are now under 50 grand, and I am quite tempted. You can get a new Defender for less than 50 grand now. It'll get you a car with a 2-litre diesel engine in it, which is probably the engine that you want in it. And I just think they are such a return to form for that company. That is a company who suddenly realized, I mean, in many ways it's, and I've said this before, there's nothing new in this thought, that it's a replacement for the Discovery 4 that I was talking about earlier. And absolutely not the Discovery 5, which is, you know, a slightly strange car in its positioning. And I just love that chunkiness, that sense of identity, the fact that it works so well, and now that they finally got the infotainment up to date, and that doesn't cheese you off every time you get it anymore. I just think that those cars are terrific. I'd want a short wheelbase right up to the moment I bought a long wheelbase one, just because the shorts are, I mean, they're hilarious, and people may remember that we ran a short wheelbase Defender 90. For the intercooler, you and I both had it for a while,
yeah.
And it was a fun thing, and it looked amazing, but it just ultimately didn't work anything like as well as something which with five doors and rear seats you can actually sort of properly access. So, I live in the absolute middle of nowhere, and sometimes you wake up in the morning, and even through the curtains, you can just tell the light's slightly different. And you throw back the curtains, and it's suddenly a winter wonderland out there.
Mm.
And whereas with almost anything else, I'd be thinking, oh dear. If I had one of those outside, I'd be thinking, whoopee. Yeah, let's go.
They are fantastic. I had a look at one. Or no, I idly thought about Defenders when buying our new family car. We got a nearly new 3 Series Touring in the end. Actually, the Defenders were more than I wanted to spend, but there is still something appealing about those.
And also, the running costs will, even with a 2-litre diesel, it ain't going to be cheap to run, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. Okay, so you wanted to do a no... what phrase am I looking for?
Money, no object?
Yes, money, no object, thank you. and I think I know what you're going to say.
You know exactly what I'm going to say.
911
Dakar. Exactly what, of course you do. 911 Dakar.
Or... I hadn't even thought of them, but goodness me, you're absolutely right.
I mean, without a second thought, or actually, and this absolutely amazed me, I drove a Sturato a week or two ago.
Mm. Go on.
Possibly the best Lamborghini I've ever driven.
Amazing, isn't it?
I mean, I was just... Sorry, this will sound incredibly sort of blasé, and that I get leaping in and out of Lamborghinis every 10 minutes. But actually, because there was a load of other stuff there, all of which required each amount of rent, I hadn't thought that much about it. I just thought, oh, it's just a sort of, jacked up Hurricane. But actually, let's just go back to the Dakar, because the same reason the Sturato is so good is the same reason the Dakar is because they haven't got, they're not cars which are endlessly chasing grip. And because they've got a bit of sidewall and they've got a bit of give in their suspension, and they're slightly higher up, and so they roll a bit more. And what that actually provides you with is feel. You just feel connected to the road in a way I'd kind of forgotten cars like that could feel connected to the road.
Mm.
And if you had a Dakar with all that extra ride height on winter tyres, I would have it completely stealth. I wouldn't have any of the liveries on it or anything like that. I would just, I'd just have it in, gentian blue or whatever. I'd try and get it debadged. I'd want there to be as little sign as possible. But on those Pirelli Scorpion tyres, what surprised me was, because I'd only driven it in wherever we went to drive it on the law. I think we were in Morocco. And it was very difficult to tell on those sort of stony, pebbly roads you get out there what the ride quality was like. But actually, in the UK, the ride was, more than good enough. And it just felt so nice to drive. You know, even when you weren't, you know, off-roading in it or trying to drive it fast, just driving it down, you know, a nice dry road, it just felt lovely. And I don't know whether it was, you know, these cars are sort of, they're thought of, aren't they, as sort of niches, as kind of slightly sort of, you know, comedy outlier cars. But actually, I think there's a really serious lesson to be learned from them, particularly for people who just love to drive, about the advantages that, you know, slightly softer setup with slightly narrower tyres can do, just in terms of what they feel like to drive. They are, you know, they are completely brilliant and money no object, absolutely without question, Dakar.
That's fascinating. And I haven't driven the Dakar or the Storato. I will drive a Dakar soon. But, I mean, it's great that the fantasies of hammering through the desert over dunes or, you know, a gravel road, not many people are going to do that, really, because those cars are still worth a lot of money. It's the bit that's intrigued me is what they are like to drive on the road with those tyres that are not fully optimised for gripping the dry, with higher ride heights. Softer suspension.
But at the same time, you know, they've got a, you know, Pirelli Sotto Zero is homologated for that car. Yeah. So you don't have to have the Scorpions. You can just put it on winters.
I'd have the winter. Yeah, that's what I'd have, yeah. And I just suspect you get a bit more body movement. They don't feel so planted and hunkered down, which can make a car feel like it's totally unimpressed with your efforts.
Yes.
So I love the idea of a Dakar. I really must get myself in one as soon as possible. Winter cars. What are you going to be driving through winter?
I don't want to tell you what I'm going to be driving through winter.
Oh.
No, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to be driving through winter.
Okay.
It's not the kind of car that you would say was a traditional winter car.
Okay. Well, no, nor's mine. I've only a couple of weeks ago took delivery of a new BMW M2 long-termer manual, which is not a winter car.
Not a winter car. Probably more of a winter car than what I'm going to be driving through winter. But I have a theory about it. I'll talk about this another day when it actually gets here, because it's not due for a while.
Okay.
That's
quite interesting.
But actually, I'll tell you what I'm going to be driving through winter. If the weather gets really, really bad, I'll be in my Series 3.
Series Land Rover. Yeah. I'm sure we won't get you out of it. Okay. Well, I look forward to finding out what car you're actually going to be driving through winter when you're ready to tell us. But we'll finish it there. We'll do a listener question now on the topic of F1, actually. Before we do that, though, remember just to subscribe to the podcast or follow the podcast. You're probably using Apple Podcasts. You might be using Spotify, and then there are a bunch of other apps that get used. But they all have a follow button or a subscribe button. It just means you can follow the show, follow the intercooler. You will never miss an episode that way, but it also really helps us. It really helps us to find a bigger audience. That's one of the main mechanisms we have of reaching out and finding a bigger audience. And if we do that, it just means we can do much, much more with the podcast. So please do that. The listener question comes from Josh Stevenson. Do you think, as fans of F1, we're too tough on the attitude of young drivers? Do we forget that these guys are often just kids when they come in? They might be late teen years. God, I think back to how immature I was at 18, 19, whatever. Are we too tough
in terms of their driving or their behaviour?
Their attitude. So, yeah, behaviour. You know, we often see them, we often hear outbursts, particularly on the radio. A lot of the time, they can seem petulant and brattish.
So certainly it happened, you know, with Lewis. It certainly happened with Max. You know, we saw Lance Stroll pushing his trainer around, didn't we? And couple of observations, slightly contradictory. But firstly, you know, we are in no position to judge the pressure these guys are under. It is absolutely enormous. And I think that there are different kinds of young drivers. I think there are young drivers who are there because they are just super talents, Lewis's and Max's. There are other young drivers who are there because they bring an awful lot of money to the business. And, you know, the dynamic is very, very different. And therefore, you could probably expect different behaviours from them. That said, it doesn't, you know, look at someone like Lando. You know, I don't think I've ever heard him, you know, behaving badly. Maybe you can remember instances, I can't. But, you know, I think that, I don't think that George has ever, you know, and okay, they're, you know, they're quite experienced Formula One drivers now, but they've been around for a bit. And when they first got in the business, you know, I think when Jensen first got into it, you know, so I don't think that it's kind of inevitable. I think certain characters are predisposed to behaving that way. But I think really we should try to be, I think we are quite understanding, generally speaking, of young drivers. But at the same time, you know, they are Formula One drivers. It's their choice to be there. They're adults. You know, I don't think it's unreasonable that they should behave themselves. But perhaps it is forgivable when sometimes they don't.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. And actually, when the sort of calmer, level-headed young guys do emerge, they really stand out because of it, don't they? And you've mentioned George in particular, Lando. I want to open this out to all F1 drivers, actually, and particularly their radio messages. And how often do we hear drivers lose their temper? We heard it yesterday at the US Grand Prix in Austin. Even Max, leading the race, he was really screaming down the radio at times. Often it goes well over the top, and it's actually not cool. But those sort of more frustrated messages that we hear from all the drivers, I totally forgive them that, because the pressure they're under is enormous. But I draw a parallel with road rage, normal road driving. We see it happen quite often. And the thing is, when we're driving a car on the road, without realising it, we're at a heightened state of alertness, of awareness, because you have to be to stay safe, to stay aware on the road. And because you're in this heightened state, without really being aware of it, it takes only a small thing to tip you over into losing your temper. That's why people seem to absolutely lose their rag over quite minor, innocuous things. And even people who are calm and level-headed otherwise, I felt that myself, and it's because you're in that heightened state. Now imagine what kind of state a Formula One driver is in, particularly when they're racing or they think there's a win on the cards, or they're struggling with something to do with the car. It's no surprise that they can be snappy and short-tempered on the radio.
Or that maybe their performances have not been those of their teammates, and they know their job is on the line, and they've got their crew chief coming on the blower saying, sorry, mate, we need another half a second of lap out of you. Even at the pathetically incomparably amateur levels at which I've done racing, I mean, I've had that call before, and it's not nice.
Oh, God.
You know, because you're already going as fast as you bloody can. And so, you know, you can, you know, you are sometimes tempted to think, you know, you think this is so bloody easy, you try it. And yeah, I think there's a difference between behaviour in the car and I think most things are forgivable in the car. I think they can be put down the heat at the moment. I think people who behave really badly in, you know, in press conferences or when they're out of the car, when they are, you know, when they don't have that excuse, when they are representing their team, I think that's altogether less forgivable, frankly, regardless of your age.
I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. Josh, thank you for your question. A good one. Keep your questions coming across and we'll do another one next week.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of
tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.